There are ex-admirals and ex-generals and Pentagon analysts that I've spoken to who privately have said, the generals and admirals, ex-retired, have said it publicly, we do not need $200 billion joint strike fighter. There's no strategic need for the F-22. There's no further need for the Osprey aircraft, which has killed 34 Marines, and 3 out of 15 of the aircraft have already crashed due to defects. There is no longer any need for $2 billion piece B-2 bombers that have lost their strategic value since the Soviet Union demise and it has trouble flying in the rain. Why are we spending this money? Because of the giant corporate influence in our Congress greasing with corporate cash this kind of misspending. A wasteful defense has always been a weak defense. Let me say that anybody who tells you that the taxpayer should not fund public elections, you tell them, corporations put $1 million in Congress, they get $1 billion back of your tax dollars in unnecessary weapon systems, in the giveaway of natural resources, in the giveaway of research and development, and so on. They put in $1 million in Congress, and they get the non-enforcement of the laws, where you get cheated, you get harmed, you get stifled, your voice is stilled. You know, that's why Will Rogers once called Congress the best money could buy. And I would add, the best money could rent, because they're very versatile now. They not only sell out, they rent themselves in order to keep a versatility going. Now, what's interesting about the military budget is when you have a bar graph, the military budget's like this, and then you have a little bit for EPA, a little bit for Head Start, a little bit for housing, a little bit for child health. You add them all up, and they don't even hardly go up to the knee of the military defense budget. That budget is draining away critical information and critical funds to build a better America and to advance health and safety here. And let me tell you, that's a national child poverty is a national security problem. Global tuberculosis and global malaria, those are national security problems for everyone. They're coming in drug-resistant form. They kill about 3-4 million people a year, including almost 1 million kids in Africa. TB, AIDS, malaria, those are the real weapons of mass destruction that we have to get a handle on. And we're spending less in our government researching drugs and vaccines and trying to help those people around the world and people in this country suffering from these diseases than one B-2 bomber. And that's got to change. 12. Why don't we highlight some of the solutions? When do these political parties ever highlight solutions? You know, it's really interesting. Gore says he's pro-business. And Bush is business. Yet you'll never see them highlight companies that have the solutions and are actually implementing them to pollution control. Companies that are treating their workers in a very superior way and giving them a stake in the capital of the company. Companies that are innovating in order to show all kinds of ways by which affordable housing can be built, by which food can be more accurately inspected for safety. You never hear from them. Because these companies destabilize the giant companies who don't want to change the way these small companies want to change. And one of them is the Interface Corporation of Atlanta, Georgia, which is the second largest commercial tile and carpet manufacturer, and from 1994 to the present has been slashing its costs as it drives towards zero pollution goals and maximum recycling goals. There are companies that know how to sell drugs at very, very cheap prices. But the 20-year-old patent monopoly laws prevent generic drug competition for 20 years, and then they try to expand it. There are elderly people that are being squeezed horribly by these fantastically high drug prices, by drug companies that already get all kinds of subsidies by the U.S. government, your tax dollars. And then they turn around, and their way of thanking the taxpayers who subsidize them through the National Institutes of Health, through research and development credits, by gouging them mercilessly. You know what the Green Party would do about drug prices? They would make sure that every drug that has a drop of taxpayer money in it is a drug that is sold under competitive prices and under reasonable price provisions, and never sold for profiteering so that people who can't afford it die. Now, all of these objectives, just list them all, and the Republicans and the Democrats are opposed to all of these objectives. In reality, and almost in rhetoric, many of them. They will not talk about people having their own media, ending corporate welfare, cracking down on corporate crime, having a foreign policy that 10 years after the Soviet Union does no longer side with dictators and oligarchs, but sides with the workers and peasants for a change. They really are not going to do anything about getting corrupt money out of politics. Neither of them wants to unilaterally disarm, as the phrase goes in Washington. They really are not going to pursue a dedicated program to abolish child poverty and poverty in this country. They are not going to do anything about the concentration of the media and the shutout of the people from their own airwaves and the need for them to have their own media. They're not going to withdraw from the WTO and NAFTA. They are not going to do anything about the concentration of corporate power over almost everything that matters in this country. They are not going to do anything about a civic curriculum where children grow up with critical, independent minds who understand what power is and understand that democracy must be strengthened against the concentration of power and wealth that funds their re-elections. They're not going to do that. And I say... You took the words out of my mouth. There's one other electoral reform I like. It's called none of the above, binding. Every line of every ballot should have the candidates and a binding none of the above. So if people are sick and tired of Tweedledee, Tweedledum, Democrat, Republican, and they don't see a Green Party on there, they can go to the polls, not stay home, vote binding none of the above, and if none of the above wins, it cancels that part of the election and sends the candidates packing and orders no election. And we also are going to make a big issue out of what Americans own but don't control, what they legally own, the public lands. They legally own $5 trillion of labor pension assets. They legally own the public airways, and the corporations directly or through their government henchmen own and control what we own. I mean, look at the extremists of these corporations. They are denying the owners of all these assets the right to control them. And they call themselves capitalists. What a joke. These giant corporations are destroying capitalism. Capitalism is the freedom to fail and the freedom to succeed. These corporations privatize their profits, but when they get into trouble, they don't go bankrupt like any small business has to. They go to Washington for a handout, a bailout, a giveaway. Well, just on a personal note, some of you may say, why after 35 years fighting for health and safety, accountable government, corporate responsibility, taking on the big guys, never letting anybody say that these are overwhelming odds. You know, when I was up against GM, that was a lot of fun, by the way. It was a wonderful time. In the mid-60s, taking on this giant, cumbersome, technologically stagnant corporation that sold millions of Americans gas-guzzling, chrome-stripped, psychosexual vehicles that weren't worth the money that was paid for, and they were very dangerous and very unsafe. People said, you can't take on GM. GM is America. What's good for GM is good for America. But I saw all too many grisly fatalities on the highway, hitchhiking the tens of thousands of miles that I used to do. And I saw them, and I began seeing things that made me think. The child that was almost decapitated in a rear-end chain collision in New England by the falling back of the guillotine-sharp glove compartment door. The motorist driver who was speared by a steering column that went right in and up, killing him almost instantly in a left-front collision. So I began studying this at law school, and I learned that in 1913, the auto companies patented a collapsible steering column, that the Roman chariots had padded dash panels, that any engineer knew how to do stronger door latches so you weren't spilled out on hard pavement after a collision, that their seat belts were developed for pilots in World War I to keep them from falling out of the plane when they went like this. But they weren't in our cars. And many other things that were invented decades ago weren't in our cars. And when I went after GM, and I did it pretty systematically, actually. It was so much fun. GM hired detective firms, and they tried to smear me, and they tried to get to Congress. And anyway, we beat them in Congress in 1966 with the motor vehicle and highway safety laws. And irregularly enforced, those laws have saved over 1 million American lives, tens of millions of injuries prevented or reduced in severity. It made imports of cars having to meet higher standards from Japan and Western Europe. And the death toll went from 5.6 fatalities per 100 million vehicle miles traveled in 1965 to last year's 1.6 fatalities for 1965. But you know, nobody could do that today. You couldn't do that today in Washington. The committees are closed to citizens who want to advance safety. The Congress has no entrance sign on it if you don't have gobs of money. The White House isn't listening. The reporters are not writing day-to-day reportorial beats on this. They like to write features when they're allowed to. And television is beyond redemption in terms of serious attention by its news office in these things. And so starting in 1980, I could see the disintegration of the Democratic Party and its move to imitate the Republican Party, to beat the Republican Party by becoming more like it. And when it doesn't beat the Republican Party, it says because it didn't take enough issues from the Republican Party. And a Democratic Party that catered to its right wing because it knew its right wing could become Republican voters, but ignored its soul, its progressive wing, because it knew its progressive wing had nowhere to go. Well, now the millions of progressive Americans have a place to go. This candidacy and the Green Party. It's enough. For years now, the Democratic Party's become very good at electing very bad Republicans. We hold them responsible for the Republican Congress. If they were the old Democratic Party, they never would have lost to the extreme wing of the opposing Republican Party in the name of Newt Gingrich, Tom DeLay, Dick Armey, and Trent Lott. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace that we can't even rely on the Democratic Party to save us from some of the most craven, vicious, evil Republicans that ever worked on Capitol Hill. We've had enough of economic growth without economic progress, without economic justice. We've had enough of a booming economy that leaves the majority of the American people behind. We've had enough of giant corporations who are keeping America down, down, down on matters of justice that count and spell our potential contribution to human beings now and in future generations. They are keeping America down environmentally. They're keeping America down in real wages. They're keeping America down in massive child poverty. They're keeping America from mobilizing for the people of this country. And until we have a new progressive political movement in this nation that is rooted in the civic culture, that knows where it's coming from, that knows where it's going, that is fueled by the spirit of justice of the American people, if we don't, until we have that underway, the sovereignty of corporations will forever replace the sovereignty of the people. And if we have a movement like that, the sovereignty of the people will replace the sovereignty of corporations. After all, we create these corporations. We charter them. We've allowed them to become persons under our Constitution. They have all the rights of real human beings, even though they're artificial entities. And they have all the privileges and immunities that these aggregations of capital and technology are capable of amassing in order to further their own immunity, their own limited liability, and their own supremacy over our political economy, our government, and our very democracy. It's time to end this. We can end this if we put the time in, if we put the will in, if we put the spirit in. The people still have the power. But as Saul Alinsky once said, the only way to fight organized money is with organized people. And I say it's time to vote our conscience, to vote our dreams, to vote our civic self-confidence, and never again trundle to the polls voting for the least of the worst and further ensuring that every 4 years both of these parties get worse. Don't we? I submit that a choice between a bad Democratic Party and a worse Republican Party is not an acceptable choice. I submit that allowing these two parties to control our government so that they don't allow democracy to do its great work in the pursuit of happiness and justice is no longer a permissive option. And we've got to change it. And you know how it gets changed? By every one of us saying that we're going to transform enthusiasm into steadfast work in the next 11 weeks to November. That we're going to go out, fan out through Portland, its suburbs, and the rest of the state of Oregon. Go out there and think of yourself as an ambassador for a new and just America. Think of yourself as an emissary for your own estimate of your significance and the mark that you want to leave on this election in November. The major parties think that third-party challenges fade away. They rise up early in the year, and then they fade away. And they're very, very smug about that. And I want to ask you here and now, all 10,000 of you, I want to ask you this question. Are we going to allow this Green Party candidacy to fade away? That means you've got to say yes to a certain number of hours in the next few weeks and to a certain number of effervescence of your own personality in terms of overcoming whatever restraint you have, whatever inhibition you have from talking to your fellow Oregonians, from even arguing with them in a nice way, from moving them from apathy to engagement, from moving them from protest to power. It was. It was that Roman orator and lawyer Cicero over 2,000 years ago who defined freedom, the best definition I've come across. He said, quote, "Freedom is participation in power," end quote. Power for what? Power of the people to pursue justice in the pursuit of happiness. Justice, the great work of human beings on earth, must become the cardinal theme of this campaign. And let me conclude on this note, that what it takes to make a major political party in this country is what I said earlier. 1 million people, 100 hours each a year, raising $100 a year. If we do that across the country, given the broad and deep agenda, the fair and far-seeing agenda of the Green Party that came out of the Denver Convention in June, if 1 million Americans pledge 100 hours a year and raise $100 a year, carrying forth this agenda, we will be a majoritarian party in a very, very fast period of time. Now I ask you, just to contemplate this challenge and think about what it must have been like and how hard it must have been to be part of the anti-slavery movement in Mississippi in 1830 or Virginia in 1850. Think of what it must have been like for women on the picket line, often subjected to fire hoses and arrests as they searched the right to vote. Think of what it must have been like for those farmers in East Texas who were beleaguered and squeezed by high freight rates by the railroads and high interest rates by the banks and could hardly make a minimal living standard, when they said enough is enough, and they organized 200,000 farmers in 6 months and spread out northwest and east and launched the populist progressive movement over the next 25 years that we're still benefiting from today. Think it must have been up against the banks, up against the railroads, no electricity, no motor vehicles, no cellular phones, no fax machines, no telephones. Think of the workers in the coal mines dying by the week from black lung disease in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and Kentucky, dying by these mine collapses. Think of what they did. They laid their entire livelihoods on the line in order to build the United Auto Workers and get decent wages and safe standards of work. Think of what they went. There was no unemployment compensation, no workers compensation, nothing but detective goons hired by the coal barons to go after these striking miners. Think of the civil rights workers in the 20th century, and of the people who said once and for all that they are not going to be discriminated against because they're black or because they're brown or because they're women or because they're gay lesbians. Think of what courage that took to step out and stand tall. Now, compare all that with what I just suggested. 1 million Americans pledging 100 hours of volunteer time a year and pledging to raise $100, coordinated and bringing forth this marvelous Green Party agenda. Does that qualify as one of history's greatest sacrifices? Of course not. It's one of history's greatest opportunities, though. And I say, Let us not be looked upon by our descendants centuries hence as the last generation that had to give up so little in order to achieve so much. The last generation that refused to look beyond the horizon. The last generation that refused to use its estimable assets and time and knowledge to build a society that goes to another level, not one just of material possessions, not one just of decent standards of living, but one where the spirit matters, one where the sense of the arts matter, one where the finer things of life for which there is so little time now, as we frantically commute longer and longer back and forth, and we frantically try to make ends meet, and we don't have time anymore for children, for family, for community, for civic engagement, leaving huge vacuums of power that are being filled by the concentrators of corporate power. And I want to end on this note. John Adams was our second president. He wasn't known for many succinct aphorisms, but there is one that I'll never forget. When he said, our generation, meaning 200 years ago, his generation, is composed of soldiers and politicians, in order for our children to be composed of doctors and scientists, in order for their children to be composed of artists and musicians. You see the progression? And you see, and you see how far away we are from that vision, almost 200 and some years later, how far away we are. People scratching around in our country to put food on the table, to get some health care, to get some voice for their grievances. And around the world, 3 billion people in semi-starvation, sick, unemployed, brutalized, and with a combined wealth equal to the 300 richest people in the world. A world racked by armaments and wars because our country, the most powerful in the world, has not pursued a policy of preventive diplomacy, preventive defense, a policy of environmental advance, a policy of global public health. Those are the purposes. Those are the great purposes that give people purpose in life. And those are the longer range purposes of this presidential and vice presidential candidacy and the growth of the Green Party. And after November, the Green Party will emerge as the green magnet, saying to the two parties, you're going to come into the arena of justice and fairness or else. And it's going to have the green hammer saying to the two parties that if you don't shape up, the Green Party will keep on growing and replace both of you as the governing party in America.
That was Ralph Nader, Green Party presidential candidate, speaking in Portland, Oregon, on August 25th. Another labor union has responded to Nader's call to build the Green Party. Between the Lines of WPKN in Bridgeport, Connecticut, has the story.
At their annual convention, August 30th, the United Electrical, Radio, and Machine Workers of America became the third union to endorse Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader. Other unions endorsing Nader include the California Nurses Association and Los Angeles Local 1108 of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Although labor has been traditionally joined at the hip to the Democratic Party, recent conflicts on free trade issues such as NAFTA and World Trade Organization policies have strained the relationship between unions and centrist New Democrats like Bill Clinton and Al Gore. While the AFL-CIO endorsed Vice President Gore's campaign early on, large unions like the United Automobile Workers, the Teamsters, and the United Steelworkers have been reluctant to endorse the Democratic ticket. Both the UAW and Teamsters interviewed Ralph Nader and publicly expressed support for his anti-free trade and pro-labor positions. The UAW has since endorsed the Gore-Lieberman campaign. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Robert Clark, Secretary-Treasurer of the United Electrical Workers, who explains why his union chose to endorse Green Party presidential candidate Ralph Nader.
That case of corporate control of the Democratic Republican parties convinced us that we had no choice but to escape the two-party trap. As you probably know, our union is one of the international unions that have endorsed the Labor Party since 1996. Look, our union have always advocated third party, a party that really represents the views of workers and not those of corporations. we're convinced that, that we did the right thing. If nothing else, if NATO win, I doubt it. But at least it pushed the Democrats, I think, more to the center. And when I say center, I mean center, not to the left, from the right to the center. We're proud and happy with our endorsement.
And Robert Clark, how did you at the union deal with the lesser evil analysis that a vote for Nader is really a vote for George W. Bush, who certainly by degree would be more unfriendly to some of your most important issues?
As a matter of fact, that was the most discussed issue. We had some people that had a real problem with that, felt that, you know, in some states, 1 or 2% of the vote would put Bush in to win. Look, you know, sooner or later, you have to stop, you know, guilt-tripping your membership to vote for the lesser two evils. The good arguments were there, that we had nothing to lose. I'm convinced that under the George Bush senior administration, he could not have gotten GATT or NAFTA passed. They elected Clinton, and he did it because he brought those Democrats that was riding the fence on that question over to the vote. There's no doubt there's some unions that's really mad at us for doing what we're doing, but we think we did the right thing. We handled the tough questions of allowing Bush to gain some scheme in certain states, but I mean, at some point in time, you have to, you know, walk the walk, and that's what we're doing.
What are some of the most important issues to the United Electrical Workers, the rank and file? What were some of the hot topics that Ralph Nader sort of won you over on?
Well, it was three or four of them. The first one was that he's made a promise to rescind all the trade deals, GATT, NAFTA, and the most recent China deal. He made a commitment to reform TAF or to repeal TAF Hartley, which is the sole problem of why we can't organize the unorganized. If you talk to any human being now that knows how this stuff works, they would agree that the Taft-Hartley Act has been the death of the union because it defined the rule on which labor have to play with, and in most cases, in almost every case, side with the bosses.
What are some of the other issues that Ralph Nader was strong on that, won your union support for him?
He was strong on the whole question of privatization, okay? He was real strong on the Social Security question. Gore have said that, you know, Social Security needs some tinkering, whatever that means. And in my mind, it means that he thinks that... That something needs to be done to fix it, which we don't think is broke. And Nader agreed on that. He's a good on environmental questions, but the most promising thing was his position on trade, you know, and how NAFTA and GATT and the China trade was bad for all countries.
What would the United Electrical Workers endorsement mean to Ralph Nader in terms of money and people power on the streets trying to get out the vote?
Well, it won't mean anything as far as money because we're a union, and I'm proud to say this, we don't have a COPE fund. But we can put some soldiers in the field for places where he's on the ballot. It's going to help him in certain states. I mean, look, I'm not going to accept that argument anymore about voting for the lesser two. Sooner or later, labor has to move. And if I thought that I was leading my union down the wrong path, if my membership voted wrong, I would say so. I mean, I'm clear that we're doing the right thing. I'm really clear on that. And I just wish there was other unions that would have enough guts to stand up to follow us. And I think there will be some.
That was Robert Clark, Secretary-Treasurer of the United Electrical Workers Union. You can contact UE by calling area code 412-471-8919.
gonna take my soul to heaven when I die. Who's gonna take my soul?
You're listening to Unwelcome Guests. I'm Chris Sturr. Next, we're going to continue our reading of Daniel Fussfeld's book, The Rise and Repression of Radical Labor, a history of the labor movement in the United States from 1877 to 1918. Last week, we read Act II, which recounted the development of industrial unions in the basic industries of steel, railroads, and mining, and the resulting division of both the labor movement and business into factions. The labor movement divided into a conservative faction which favored collective bargaining within the current economic order, and a radical faction which favored changing the economic order of capitalism. Business was divided between anti-union business leaders and the emerging corporate liberals who favored collective bargaining with unions in order to maintain industrial peace. This week, we'll read Act III, which recounts in detail the anthracite coal strike of 1902. That strike provides an example of how conservative union leaders, business leaders subscribing to corporate liberalism, and government officials wielding state power joined together to support a policy of collective bargaining in labor-business relations. This has been a policy which requires the repression of radical labor and which rules out challenges to the capitalist system. Act 3, Anthracite, 1902. The anthracite coal strike of 1902 brought together all of the key issues in the struggle between labor and management. It involved an industry supplying an essential commodity to millions of people. At the turn of the century, anthracite coal was the chief fuel for heating urban homes, and thus aroused intense public interest and emotions. Management in the industry was opposed to negotiations and any form of union recognition. The United Mine Workers, however, were committed to collective bargaining and were willing to work with the corporate liberals of the National Civic Federation. Within the union, however, a powerful group supported a strategy of labor solidarity and class struggle. Ultimately, the federal government interceded to force management to accept a settlement. This was the first instance of the alliance between business unionism, corporate liberalism, and state power that, in somewhat different form a third of a century later, was to bring national legislation requiring employers to bargain collectively with unions. The anthracite coal miners had won an earlier strike in 1900, in which they not only obtained an increase in wage rate and other improvements, but also greatly strengthened their union organization. Nevertheless, only a small proportion of the anthracite miners were members of the United Mine Workers when the 1902 strike began. The employers apparently decided to try to break the union. Negotiations with the union had brought a wage increase in 1900, which was extended for a second year. The union wanted to reopen negotiations, but company management refused to negotiate and sought to harass and weaken the union. Early in 1902, the union leadership sought the assistance of the National Civic Federation. Senator Mark Hanna was successful in setting up a meeting between four union officials, including John Mitchell, president of the UMW, with four representatives of the largest anthracite mining companies. But the companies refused to make any concessions on the union demands and agreed only to a 30-day truce. At the end of the 30 days, a subcommittee of union and management representatives again failed to reach an agreement. The union demands were moderate: recognition of the union as bargaining agent, an increase in wages to a standard 60 cent per ton of coal mined, weighing of coal in the presence of union-paid check weighmen, and an eight-hour day. The union proposed that if no agreement was reached, the issues would be submitted to binding arbitration by a committee selected by the National Civic Federation, or by a committee of Catholic bishops suggested by Mitchell. The union proposed that if the committee found that anthracite miners received an annual income sufficient to live and raise their families at a level consistent with the American standard of living, and that no changes in wages and working conditions were necessary, the union would withdraw its demands, provided the companies agreed to accept the decision of the arbitration committee. It was a clever proposal on the part of the union that appealed to the public's sense of fair play and feeling for equity, and it stressed the union's desire for a peaceful settlement. Management rejected the proposal. The strike began on May 14, 1902, timed to forestall production of coal stocks for the coming winter heating season. The companies moved to hire some 1,600 private police and recruited labor from outside the region. Many shopkeepers in the mining towns refused credit to the strikers. Initially, there was no violence, but the use of strikebreakers soon triggered retaliation and brought scattered episodes of violence and a number of shooting deaths in June and July. These incidents were publicized heavily and used to discredit the strike and the union. By the end of July, the anthracite region was in turmoil, and the governor of Pennsylvania ordered two regiments of the National Guard to the area. Nevertheless, violence escalated and more troops were required. By the end of September, 14 people had died as a result of the strike, and property losses were substantial. Meanwhile, a struggle was going on within the union between the leadership, which wanted to localize the conflict within the anthracite region, and a dissident group among the rank and file that wanted to broaden the strike to include the whole coal mining industry in the interests of worker solidarity. The union president, John Mitchell, feared that public opinion would turn against the strike if the bituminous miners walked out in sympathy with the anthracite miners. A bituminous coal strike of any length would shut down the railroads quickly and the steel industry in a short time, and those shutdowns would soon spread to many other industries with effects analogous to a general strike. Mitchell argued that public opinion would shift against the strike and many other workers would be alienated if the bituminous miners went out to support their fellow UMW miners. Furthermore, the bituminous miners were working under a valid contract, the result of earlier negotiations. If the union should abandon this contract and the validity of collectively bargained agreements, it would be opting for class action and giving up the principle of collective bargaining and the idea of binding negotiated settlements. Mitchell was also under heavy pressure from Senator Marcus Hanna of the National Civic Federation, who argued that the whole philosophy of collective bargaining and mutual recognition of each other's position by capital and labor would be jeopardized and perhaps destroyed if the bituminous miners denounced their contract. The union opposition to Mitchell, on the other hand, argued that a bituminous coal strike would threaten the financial interests that lay behind the anthracite coal companies because of the general economic shutdown it could bring, and thereby bring the anthracite strike to a quick and successful conclusion. This strategy was designed to win on a small front by threatening a general and devastating confrontation between labor and capital. There could hardly have been a clearer confrontation between two ideologies: class struggle versus peaceful negotiation, antagonistic conflict versus non-antagonistic conflict. The issue was decided at a special national convention of the United Mine Workers in mid-July. The convention decided not to call for a national sympathy strike of bituminous coal miners. Instead, it provided for financial assistance from the union as a whole, as well as general support. Mitchell had won. The UMW decided for business unionism and collective bargaining rather than class solidarity and a capital labor confrontation. Public opinion soon moved to support of the strike, influenced by the union leadership's continuing stance of conciliation and an effective public relations program. But the most spectacular cause of the shift in public opinion was an injudicious letter written by George F. Baer, president of the Philadelphia and Reading Railroad, which was the largest producer of anthracite coal, to a resident of Wilkes-Barre. Quote, "Dear Mr. Clark, I have your letter of the 16th. I do not know who you are. I see that you are a religious man, but you are evidently biased in favor of the right of the working man to control a business in which he has no other interest than to secure fair wage for the work he does. I beg you not to be discouraged. The rights and interests of the laboring man will be protected and cared for, not by the labor agitators, but by the Christian men to whom God, in his infinite wisdom, has given the control of the property interests of the country, and upon the successful management of which so much depends. Do not be discouraged. Pray earnestly that right may triumph, always remembering that the Lord God Omnipotent still reigns, and that his reign is one of law and order, not of violence and crime." End quote. This arrogant and paternalistic statement of the divine right of capital, published at the end of August and widely disseminated by the Union, was heavily criticized in newspaper editorials and badly damaged the public image of the coal operators. The situation was serious. Coal production had fallen and failed to revive, stocks were low, and prices began to increase. A cold and expensive winter loomed ahead for the urban population of the great eastern cities. President Theodore Roosevelt, in office for only a year and not an elected president, called a special cabinet meeting to discuss the problem on October 1st. This was followed by a high-level meeting at the White House on October 3rd involving the labor leaders, presidents of the leading coal-carrying railroads, which controlled some 90% of anthracite coal production, and high government officials. The union leaders proposed a federal commission to investigate the situation and to decide the issues, with both sides required to accept its decision. A spokesman for the operators rejected this arbitration proposal and instead asked for federal troops to protect the mines so they could keep operating. The governor of Pennsylvania, supporting the companies, responded to this plea by ordering the entire Pennsylvania National Guard to the anthracite region. But the strike continued to be effective and output remained low. Roosevelt appealed to Mitchell to send the miners back to work, promising to appoint the commission requested by Mitchell and to try to get the operators to accept its decision. Mitchell refused. On October 9th, a meeting of 139 mayors at Detroit called for government control of the anthracite mines. President Roosevelt was caught in a dilemma. Ideologically, he was part of the liberal wing of the Republican Party, where support for the position of the National Civic Federation on labor matters was strong. Marcus Hanna, U.S. Senator from Ohio and president of the Federation, was probably the most important Republican politician in the country after Roosevelt himself. Hanna wore two hats as the most prominent leader of the corporate liberals and a leading political figure in the administration. On the other hand, the bulk of Republican political funds came from conservative business and financial leaders like J.P. Morgan, who were adamantly anti-union. Indeed, Morgan and his associates were the chief investment bankers for the railroads that owned the bulk of the anthracite mines. They must have approved the union-busting strategy of the companies, although Morgan persistently denied that he attempted to influence management decisions on the matter. Just as an internal struggle was going on in the union, so a similar struggle went on within the administration and the Republican leadership. In the end, government sided with the union. Roosevelt decided, in the face of the operators' intransigence, that the federal government would have to seize the mines and send U.S. troops into the mining areas to get production started once more. With that plan as a big stick, he sent Secretary of State Elihu Root to speak softly with J.P. Morgan, carrying a plan for a federal commission of inquiry whose findings would be binding on both sides of the dispute. The only concession Morgan could get was that no labor leader or former labor leader would be appointed to the commission. Even that concession was not honored, however, for Roosevelt appointed to the commission as a quote-unquote sociologist, a member of the Interstate Commerce Commission who had formerly been president of the Order of Railway Conductors. The strikers went back to work after the operators agreed to accept the decision of the commission as binding. A cold winter had been averted. The commission held extensive hearings during the winter of 1902 and 1903 and handed down its decision on March 18, 1903. It awarded a 10% wage increase and made several other recommendations. But it did not require recognition of the union as bargaining agent for the miners. That was not obtained until World War I, when the federal government required it of the operators as a means of obtaining labor peace during the war. All this was anticlimax, however. The real meaning of the anthracite coal strike of 1902 lay in the use of state power to support the coalition of conservative unions and corporate liberalism around the idea of collective bargaining and peaceful settlement of labor management differences. The anthracite coal strike of 1902 forged for the first time the basic political alignments that were to lead to a national policy of collective bargaining in labor management relations. That was Act 3 of The Rise and Repression of Radical Labor. In next week's show, we will finish the book with Act 4, entitled The Crushing of Radical Labor, as well as the book's epilogue. The song accompanying this segment has been True Religion, performed by the Weavers.
When I get that true religion, hallelujah. When I get that true religion, hallelujah. When I get that true religion.
Powerful alien. regarding Franklin's influence. Quote, his house at Posse at once became the headquarters of the agitators. He was the high priest of the philosophers, the messiah of the malcontents, the patron of the framers of all systems. People wrote to him from all quarters, begging him for advice, unquote. In France, Franklin was an outside agitator, spreading dangerous and subversive ideas about the uselessness of kings in the land ruled by Louis XVI. A young French lawyer was inspired by him and dedicated his first speech in court to the American. That lawyer was Robespierre, one of the most radical of the French revolutionaries. Today, who calls Franklin, Jefferson, or Thomas Paine, who was made a French citizen after the revolution and elected deputy for Pas-de-Calais, outside agitators? The great African-American scholar, Oliver Cox, wrote in his book Caste, Class, and Race, in political class conflict, the ruling class will always be intolerant. Speech is never free to be used as a threat to the reign of a political class, unquote. Now, isn't that precisely what was shown in Philadelphia, the so-called Cradle of Liberty, which threw over 400 men and women into their most vile dungeon, Holmesburg Prison, the second oldest prison in America? Didn't they show this when they hit young protesters with fines of up to $1 million called bail? For daring to exercise their alleged rights of free speech and protest, they were denied every other so-called right imaginable. For true revolutionaries, there is no outside. For boundaries of race and of caste and of language, gender, and nationality fade into the commonality of human and indeed of life. To the state, which draws its very meaning from social conflict and separation, nothing could be more dangerous. We must all learn from this and build from this, for revolution isn't a dinner party. It's a struggle to really transform and change things. Let us begin. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The rangers and deputies are hired by the rich man.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us through our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content.
Catch me napping one day and they'll kill me. Then I'll be gone, but that won't be my end. For my guns and my saddle will all